Let's unpack this. Have you, like us, been feeling a real disconnect in what you hear about the housing market? On one hand, we're constantly bombarded with stories about sky-high prices, seemingly defying gravity. Yet, almost in the same breath, you hear news about slow sales, maybe even some price cuts in certain areas. It's truly confusing, isn't it? It feels like the market is doing everything and nothing all at once, leaving most of us just, you know, scratching our heads. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the U.S. residential construction sector and the broader housing market. This isn't just about headlines. It's based on a comprehensive analysis of the current situation that tries to cut through all that noise. Our mission, to give you the clearest picture of what's really happening, why it profoundly matters for you, and what to look for next as we navigate these incredibly complex waters. This deep dive is designed specifically to help you be truly well-informed about this vital sector of our economy.
And what's fascinating here, I think, is that our sources for this deep dive are primarily from an investment analysis perspective, which means they're not merely reporting on the news or just giving us the what. They're trying to identify the underlying forces at play, you know, dissecting the structural challenges and, crucially, pinpointing strategic opportunities within this often challenging environment. It gives us a really unique and, frankly, practical lens to view what's happening on the ground.
That's a perfect lens for this. And it brings us right to what I think is the core paradox of the U.S. housing market right now. It's not collapsing, thankfully, but it's very much stuck in a profound state of what our sources call the Great Stagnation.
Yeah.
This isn't a repeat of 2008, right?
Yeah.
Where we saw a credit-driven collapse that brought the whole system down. Okay. So if it's not a collapse, what is this Great Stagnation? What defines this unique crisis we find ourselves in?
Yeah, that's precisely the right question to anchor our discussion. We're calling this the Great Stagnation because it's, well, it's a collision of incredibly powerful, almost contradictory forces. On one side, you have very strong underlying demographic demand, a massive wave of potential home buyers, really. But on the other side, this demand is being absolutely suffocated by an unprecedented housing affordability crisis. This is driven by historically high home prices and, critically, that rapid surge we saw in mortgage rates. And the market is then further paralyzed by what our sources term the rate lock-in effect, essentially creating, well, golden handcuffs for existing homeowners. This dynamic has fundamentally frozen the existing home market because there's such a powerful financial disincentive for current homeowners to sell.
Golden handcuffs. I love that term. It really captures it. So we have this huge underlying demand, but people can't afford to buy, and those who own can't really afford to sell.
No.
What does that look like in terms of actual homes changing hands? What's the impact on the ground?
It creates a profoundly bifurcated and, frankly, dysfunctional landscape. Consider this. Transaction volumes for existing homes, you know, the typical homes people sell to each other, have plummeted. They're at their lowest levels in nearly three decades.
Three decades. Wow.
Yeah, it's huge. Yet, despite this near collapse in sales, we haven't seen a significant price correction nationally. And the reason? Because there's a chronic undersupply of housing units. There simply aren't enough homes to go around, even with fewer buyers able to actually make a purchase. So in this environment, new construction has become the only functional available for sale inventory. It's really the only game in town.
So new construction is effectively the only option for many buyers.
Sure.
What does that mean for the companies actually building these homes? Are we seeing a shift in who has power in this market?
Absolutely. It's a dramatic shift. This structural dynamic has granted large, well-capitalized public home builders, think the giants with strong balance sheets and deep pockets, unprecedented market power. They're able to capture a disproportionate share of what little transaction activity remains, even as the overall market is weak. And this leads us directly to the core investment thesis highlighted in our sources. They believe this downturn, characterized by stagnation rather than outright collapse, actually offers a strategic opportunity for those positioned correctly. The thesis is centered on three key themes that seem to define success in this environment. First, scale is a moat. The largest public home builders, with their superior access to capital and sophisticated land acquisition strategies, are systematically taking market share from smaller, capital-constrained private builders. These smaller guys just can't compete, especially when incentives like rate buydowns are often needed to close a deal.
Okay, so bigger is better right now. What else?
Second, innovation as a margin driver. Companies leveraging cutting-edge technologies like construction technology or ConTech things like modular building and 3D printing, or property technology, prop tech, which streamlines sales and financing, they're achieving superior operational efficiency and better cost control. And that translates directly into more resilient profit margins, which is key. And finally, the third theme is essential and non-discretionary dominance. So firms that supply fundamental building products and services like aggregates or cement, the real basic stuff, are showing greater resilience and pricing power throughout the economic cycle compared to those exposed to more discretionary consumer spending.
Okay, that makes sense. The essentials hold up better.
Exactly. So based on this, the report recommends a BUY rating on select public home builders, specifically citing Lennar and D.R. Horton, and also on building material suppliers like CRH PLC. Conversely, it advises a hold or neutral view for more cyclically exposed subsectors, like mortgage finance and home improvement retail. This framework truly helps us understand not just the what, but the why and how of these market dynamics.
That's a fantastic framework for understanding the landscape. Let's really dig deeper into those opposing forces you mentioned, starting with the demand side. On paper, when you look at demographics, it sounds like we should have a booming housing market, right? All those millennials and Gen Zs coming of age. But something is clearly off. Where's that disconnect coming from?
You're absolutely right to point out the demographic tailwinds. I mean, the foundation of any housing market is household formation, right? And the U.S. is uniquely positioned with the two largest generations in its history entering their prime home buying years. Millennials have now surpassed baby boomers as the largest adult generation. They make up over 50% of all home buyers today.
Over half, wow.
Yeah. And right behind them, Gen Z, a similarly sized cohort, is starting to enter the market. So this structural support means there's a deep and sustained underlying need for new housing units of all types across the country. Just a fundamental need. And we're already seeing some interesting shifts in buyer behavior and household composition driven by these demographics. For instance, the median age of a first-time homebuyer has actually climbed to 36. It was 33 just a few years ago.
36, so people are waiting longer.
Exactly. It suggests longer periods of renting and saving before they can finally jump into homeownership. Also, household composition is changing significantly. Single-person households now make up 28% of all U.S. households. That's a dramatic increase from just 13% back in 1960.
That's a huge shift.
It is. And it drives demand for smaller units, like apartments and condos. But simultaneously, there's a resurgence in multi-generational living. Nearly one in five Americans now living with extended family. And that creates a need for larger homes, often with features like dual master suites or accessory dwelling units. So all of these trends collectively point to a powerful intrinsic demand for more housing units than we currently have.
So we have this massive growing pool of potential buyers who want homes, who need homes, but they're clearly not actually buying them at the rate you'd expect. What's standing in their way? It sounds like it boils down to affordability.
Precisely. This is where the powerful demographic demand collides head-on with an unprecedented affordability crisis. The number's quite stark, really. The national home price-to-income ratio, which is a key measure of affordability, hit a record high of 5.6 in 2022. To put that in perspective, it means the median single-family home costs 5.6 times the median household income. That's the highest level recorded since the early 1970s.
5.6 times income. That's high.
It is. And the long-term trend is even more sobering. Between 1985 and 2023, the nominal median price of houses sold in the U.S. climbed by over 400%.
400%?
Yeah. While the nominal median household income grew by just over 240%, this enormous widening gap has made homeownership simply unattainable for a large and growing segment of the population.
Wow. Over 400% price growth versus just over 240% income growth. That's a fundamental shift in what the American dream of homeownership truly means, isn't it? And this isn't just a national average, is it? It's even more acute in major cities.
You're absolutely right. This isn't just a national average. It's even worse in many major metropolitan areas. In 2022, nearly half, almost 50 out of the 100 largest U.S. markets had price-to-income ratios exceeding 5.0. And some of the West Coast markets, I mean, San Jose had an astonishing 12.0. 12. And San Francisco was at 11.3, both well above that 8.0 threshold that usually signals extreme unaffordability. Imagine needing 12 years of the median income just to afford the median home price in San Jose. It's staggering. And the direct consequence of this affordability crisis is a projected slowdown in the rate of new household formation. While the demographic potential for new households is there, the economic reality creates a significant barrier. Projections from the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University anticipate that annual household growth in the U.S. will slow, from an average of about 1.1 million per year in the 2010s to just 860,000 per year between 2025 and 2035.
So fewer new households forming than we might expect based on population alone.
Exactly. This projected slowdown, driven by the inability of younger generations to form independent households due to financial constraints, poses a significant long-term threat to the baseline demand for new housing construction.
So if the average American is sidelined, as you put it, who is actually buying homes right now? Who makes up the active buyer pool?
That's the result of this collision of forces. It's fractured the market. The active buyer pool right now is disproportionately composed of more affluent individuals, people who are less sensitive to high interest rates and prices. We see this clearly in the resilience of the luxury housing market, where all cash deals have become increasingly common.
Ah, the cash buyers.
Right. In stark contrast, the share of first-time home buyers, who are most sensitive to affordability and typically purchase entry-level homes, has fallen dramatically. Historically, they were around 40% of sales. Now it's down to just 30%. This means the average American household is effectively sidelined, unable to participate in the current market. It creates a truly bifurcated demand profile. It's, you know, relatively healthy at the top end, but largely frozen at the bottom and middle. And this environment is also forcing a reevaluation of the traditional American dream, that single-family detached home. It's no longer a realistic starting point for many. Faced with these extreme affordability challenges, younger generations like Gen Z and millennials are demonstrating a greater willingness to embrace higher density housing options.
Like townhomes, condos.
Exactly. Townhomes, condominiums, smaller units as their first step into home ownership. This isn't merely a lifestyle preference. For many, it's a financial necessity. And this structural shift in demand will clearly favor builders who possess the expertise and land positions to deliver more affordable, higher density attached products. Especially in desirable suburban and some call suburban, that sort of suburban, urban hybrid locations.
Okay, so demand is clearly there, the people are there, but affordability is hitting it hard, especially for first-time buyers. That's one side of the coin. What about supply? We keep hearing about a massive shortage, but then, like we said, some places have homes sitting on the market. How do we reconcile that seemingly contradictory information?
That's the other half of the paradox, and it's equally dysfunctional, really. The supply side of the U.S. housing market is defined by a long-term structural deficit, a deficit that has been acutely exacerbated by a near-total paralysis of the existing home market. The nation entered the current crisis with a massive housing shortage. This is the result of more than a decade of underbuilding in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis.
Right, we never really caught up after that.
We didn't. Estimates of this deficit range from 3.8 million to as high as 6 million homes needed to create a truly balanced market. And this chronic undersupply is the fundamental reason why home prices have not collapsed despite the sharp drop in demand. The shortages are most severe in land-constrained coastal states. Hawaii faces something like a 14.1% inventory deficit relative to its existing housing stock. California is next at 12.2%. New York around 8.5%.
Wow, significant shortages.
Very significant. Now, when we look at national inventory data, it paints a picture of what we might call a false equilibrium. As of June 2025, there were about 1.53 million unsold existing homes on the market. That translates to a 4.7-month supply at the current sales pace.
Which sounds okay. Isn't 5 or 6 months considered balanced?
It sounds okay on the surface, but it's really a statistical artifact. This apparent balance has been achieved through a healthy increase in new listings coming onto the market. It's primarily happened through a collapse in sales volume. There simply aren't many transactions happening. In stark contrast, the supply of newly built homes is quite elevated. As of June 2025, there was a 9.8-month supply of new homes for sale.
Nearly 10 months. That's high.
It is, a level not seen since the aftermath of the 2008 housing bust. This reflects both some speculative building by developers, maybe, and the broader slowdown in buyer traffic hitting the new home market, too.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. You mentioned it earlier. The golden handcuffs effect. This seems to be the linchpin, effectively freezing the existing home market. Can you walk us through how significant this really is?
It truly is the primary cause of the frozen resale market, and it's a profound structural consequence of the Federal Reserve's actions over the last few years. The aggressive monetary policy during the pandemic allowed millions of homeowners to purchase or refinance at historically low interest rates. Rock bottom rates. It's estimated that roughly 60% of current homeowners with a mortgage have a rate below 4%.
60% below 4%.
It's huge. Now, with current 30-year fixed rates hovering near 7%, there's an almost insurmountable financial disincentive preventing these homeowners from selling. A move would require them to forfeit their low-cost mortgage and take on a new, much more expensive one. It could potentially increase their monthly payment by nearly 50% for a similarly priced home.
50% increase.
Yeah.
Nobody wants that.
Exactly. This phenomenon, aptly referred to as golden handcuffs, has effectively paralyzed the resale market. Research from the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the FHFA, concluded that this lock-in effect prevented an estimated 1.7 million home sales between 2022 and 2024.
Prevented 1.7 million sales.
Yes. And by artificially constraining supply, it actually contributed to a 7% increase in home prices over what they otherwise would have been.
Wow. So it didn't just slow sales. It actually pushed prices up because supply was so tight. That's counterintuitive, but makes sense. So essentially, we've got homeowners sitting on gold. Maybe, but they can't cash it in without taking a massive hit to their monthly budget. That's quite a pickle for the market. What does this mean for the new construction market in comparison?
It creates a stark divergence. The resale market is effectively frozen, transaction volumes at 30-year lows. For buyers who must move due to unavoidable life events, things like job relocations, family changes, needing more space, the pool of available existing homes is critically small. This leaves the new construction market as pretty much the only functional source of inventory. Public home builders, with their relatively ample supply of homes under construction and their ability to offer financial incentives like those mortgage rate buy-downs, they are uniquely positioned to capture this demand. They are no longer just competing with each other. They are, in a sense, competing against a non-existent resale market,
right,
which provides them with a profound structural advantage and unprecedented market power that will likely persist as long as interest rates remain significantly above the levels we saw in 2020 and 2021.
Now, some might worry that if rates do eventually come down significantly, say back to 5% or something, we'll see a flood of these locked-in sellers suddenly hit the market, maybe causing a crash. Is that a real risk, or is it maybe overstated?
Our sources suggest this risk appears overstated. The financial disincentive to move is so substantial that a marginal rate decrease, for instance, from 7% down to 6% is unlikely to trigger a mass sell-off.
Yeah, 6% is still way higher than 3 or 4%.
Exactly. Think about it. A 1% drop might save you a bit, but it's still far from the 3-4% rates many homeowners enjoy. A recent survey even found that over half of homeowners would not be comfortable selling their home this year, regardless of what happens with mortgage rates. That indicates a deep psychological anchoring to their low monthly payments. The lock-in effect is more likely to unwind gradually over a multi-year period, driven by the slow but steady pace of life events that force households to move: death, divorce, relocation, etc. It's like a gradual normalization of resale inventory would actually be a healthy rebalancing, not a catastrophic shock to the market.
Okay, that's somewhat reassuring. So if supply is so constrained by this lock-in and the overall shortage is so severe, why aren't prices soaring even more, pushing them even higher? And why, as we noted, are we hearing about price declines in some specific areas if there's such a national shortage? That sounds like a fundamental contradiction to most listeners. How do you square that circle?
That's an excellent point, and it really speaks to the nuance of this stagnation. The extreme supply constraints we've discussed have indeed led to a surprising resilience in home prices, even as sales have cratered. The national median existing home sales price actually reached an all-time high of $435,300 in June 2025.
An all-time high, even now.
Oh, yes. Now, if we connect this to the bigger picture, this record price is a direct consequence of too few homes being available for the buyers who remain in the market, especially the more affluent ones. But, and this is a big but, it masks a more complex reality. Forecasts from major real estate analytics firms for the remainder of 2025 largely point toward a period of price stagnation or even modest declines nationally. Zillow and Redfin, for example, both project a modest year-over-year decline of around 1-2% by the end of the year. Others, like Realtor.com and JP Morgan, anticipate slight growth, maybe in the 2.5-3.0% range. So the consensus is clear. The market is facing a period of flat to slightly declining prices nationally, not a sharp correction like 2008. And if we look at some key data points, existing home sales are projected to be around 4 million units in 2025. That's down significantly. New home sales are slightly up to just over 600,000, but the average 30-year fixed mortgage rate is holding steady around 6.7%, and that new home inventory is still elevated at nearly 10 months of supply. So a mixed bag.
Okay, so we're seeing a kind of national stability, maybe a slight dip in prices, but what about regional differences? Is everyone experiencing the same thing, or is it very location dependent?
Not at all. It's very location dependent. This national stability, however, truly masks a significant regional divergence. The pandemic boom towns, the places that saw the most dramatic price appreciation, are now experiencing the most significant corrections. Austin, Texas, for example, stands out. Prices there have fallen a staggering 23% from their 2022 peak.
23%?
Yeah, it's a big drop. Other markets seeing notable declines include Oakland, California, down 22%, San Francisco, down 16%, Phoenix, down about 9%. This cooling is concentrated in the South and West, where inventory levels have maybe recovered a bit more quickly, or where prices just got way ahead of fundamentals. In contrast, markets in the Northeast and Midwest, which suffer from more severe and long-standing inventory shortages, have seen prices remain more stable or even continue to appreciate modestly.
Okay, so a real split, depending on where you live. So what does this all mean for that headline record price we hear about nationally? Is it truly a sign of broad market strength, or is there more to the story there?
That's a critical nuance, and it largely comes down to what's known as the composition effect.
The composition effect. Okay, what's that?
Basically, with first-time buyers who typically purchase homes at lower price points, largely driven from the market due to affordability issues.
Right, they can't afford to buy.
Exactly. So the mix of homes actually being sold is skewed toward more expensive properties. The continued activity in the more resilient luxury segment further pulls the median upward. Therefore, the headline record price is not necessarily a sign of broad market strength. It's more of a statistical artifact of a fractured market where lower-end transaction volume has essentially evaporated.
Ah, so the average is pulled up because only the expensive stuff is selling.
Pretty much. If market conditions were to allow for the return of entry-level buyers, the median price could actually decline simply due to a shift in the composition of sales, even without a broad-based fall in individual home values. It's a very important distinction for understanding the true health of the market.
That makes perfect sense. So with the resale market frozen and the price data being a bit of an optical illusion maybe, new construction is the only game in town. Is it actually rising to the occasion? Is it building enough to make a dent in that massive housing shortage we talked about?
Unfortunately, no. It's largely failing to keep up. While new construction is the sole engine of supply right now, the sector itself is facing significant headwinds. This leads to a subdued pace of building that is just insufficient to close the nation's housing deficit. According to the latest data for June 2025 from the U.S. Census Bureau, housing starts were at a seasonally adjusted annual rate of just over 1.3 million units. That's actually down slightly from the previous year. Single-family starts, the backbone of the for-sale market, stood at around 880,000. And multifamily starts, they've fallen sharply to a rate of just over 400,000.
Multifamily's down sharply. Why is that?
Mostly interest rates again. Higher rates make the economics of large-scale rental projects much tougher for developers. We'll touch on that more. But looking ahead, building permits, which are a forward-looking indicator, were at an annual rate of nearly 1.4 million. That's down over 4% year over year, signaling continued weakness ahead. And housing completions homes actually finished were at a rate of just over 1.3 million. That's a steep 24% decline from June 2024.
24% decline in completion. That's big.
It is. It reflects the slowdown in projects that were initiated 12 to 18 months prior, right as high interest rates began to bite. So this current pace of construction is, at best, just treading water. With underlying demand from new household formation estimated at between 1.1 and 1.4 million units per year, plus that pre-existing deficit of millions of homes, current building rates are simply insufficient to make meaningful progress on the housing shortage.
That's a huge structural problem for the country.
Yeah.
You mentioned multifamily starts are sharply down. What are the implications of that for the rental market? Because not everyone can buy, obviously.
Right. The sharp downturn in multifamily construction is particularly concerning for exactly that reason. Higher interest rates have made the economics of large-scale rental projects untenable for many developers, leading them to shelve or cancel projects. Now, currently, the market is absorbing a wave of new apartment completions from projects started back during the 2022-2023 boom.
Ah. So there's a lag.
Exactly. And that's temporarily softening rent growth in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
But the lack of new starts today points to a looming supply cliff in 2026 and 2027. Once the current pipeline of new units is delivered and absorbed, the lack of new projects breaking ground today will inevitably lead to a shortage of new rental supply in the future.
Which means rents could start climbing again.
Precisely. This could cause a reacceleration of rent inflation, further exacerbating the overall housing affordability crisis, and in turn, It could create a kind of vicious cycle where unaffordable rents push more people to attempt to buy, inadvertently supporting home prices despite poor affordability.
Wow, a potential rental supply cliff too. Okay, so it's clear interest rates are a huge factor in absolutely all this. They're like the central gravitational force pulling everything else. Let's really dig into the Federal Reserve's role and what that means for your mortgage and the wider housing market. What's the Fed's stance right now, and what are the experts predicting for rates moving forward?
Yeah, the trajectory of the U.S. housing market for the foreseeable future is absolutely inextricably linked to the path of interest rates and the monetary policy decisions of the Federal Reserve. High rates are the primary cause of the current stagnation, influencing every aspect of the market from consumer demand and builder financing to that structural paralysis of the rate lock-in effect we just discussed. Following a series of three rate cuts that concluded back in late 2024, the Federal Reserve has maintained a pretty steady policy stance through the first half of 2025. They've held their benchmark federal funds rate in a range of 4.25% to 4.50%.
So holding steady for a while now.
The Fed's rationale for this pause is the persistence of inflation. It's remained stubbornly above its 2% target. And there's even some new upward pressure from recently imposed tariffs on imported goods, which complicates things. So the consensus among economists and market analysts is that the Fed will likely remain on hold for most of the remainder of 2025. Projections suggest that if inflation continues to moderate, the central bank might initiate a cautious easing cycle, maybe 50 basis points of cuts, in the final quarter of the year. But that's a big if.
Cautious easing, maybe late this year. What does that mean for actual mortgage rates people pay?
Well, this outlook has directly shaped forecasts for mortgage rates. The 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, which averaged around 6.7% in 2024, is expected to see only a modest decline through 2025. Fannie Mae and Realtor.com both project a year-end 2025 rate of around 6.4%. The Mortgage Bankers Association and JP Morgan are slightly more pessimistic, anticipating rates to end the year still around 6.7%.
So basically flat or maybe dipping just a little bit below 6.5% by year-end.
Exactly. The general expectation is that rates won't breach the 6% threshold in 2025, which raises an important question. What would it take for a significant recovery? Our sources suggest rates would need to fall back toward 5% or lower, and that level isn't anticipated in any mainstream forecast until 2026 at the earliest, maybe even later.
So we're stuck with higher rates for a while, it seems. And it's not just buyers affected. Builders are clearly feeling the pinch on two fronts, as you mentioned earlier. Can you explain that sensitivity for us? How does it hit them?
Absolutely. The housing market's sensitivity to these elevated rates is extreme, impacting both the demand and supply sides of the equation. On the consumer side, potential home buyers are acutely aware of and responsive to changes in mortgage rates. Even small moves matter. A bank rate survey revealed that 40% of homeowners would need to see rates fall below 6% before they would feel comfortable purchasing another home.
A low 6%. That's a key psychological level.
It seems to be. This sentiment is clearly reflected in the Fannie Mae Home Purchase Sentiment Index, which registered its first year-over-year decline in nearly 2 years in early 2025. And that decline was driven primarily by consumer pessimism regarding the future direction of mortgage rates. The vast majority of consumers continue to believe it is a bad time to buy a home, citing high prices and high rates. The National Association of Realtors chief economist estimates that a drop in the 30-year rate to 6% would catalyze an additional 500,000 home sales annually.
500,000 more sales just from getting to 6%?
Yeah, that's the estimate. This sensitivity is visible in real time through the weekly mortgage application survey, which shows purchase application volumes fluctuating in tight correlation with weekly rate movements. Up a bit when rates dip, down when they rise. Now for home builders, the impact is twofold. First, elevated mortgage rates directly suppress demand from potential buyers. This leads to a sharp decline in foot traffic to new home communities. The prospective buyer traffic component of the NAHB Wells Fargo Housing Market Index, the HMI, fell to a more than two-year low in mid-2025. And this has pushed overall builder sentiment, as measured by the HMI, into deeply negative territory. It had a reading of just 33 in July 2025, remember. Any reading below 50 indicates that more builders view conditions as poor than good.
So builders are really feeling it from the demand side, fewer buyers walking in the door. But what about their own costs, their financing? How do higher rates affect them there?
That's the second front, and it's just as painful. High rates directly increase builders' cost of capital. Rates on loans for acquisition, development, and construction, or ED&C loans, as they're known, have continued to climb. The average effective rate on speculative single-family construction loans rose from around 7.5% to over 8% in early 2023 and likely hasn't improved much.
Ouch, over 8% for construction loans.
Yeah, that really squeezes project profitability and makes it more difficult to secure financing for new projects, which constrains future supply. In response to this dual pressure of weak demand and high costs, builders have been forced to offer significant incentives. We mentioned rate buy-downs, but also in July 2025, a record 38% of builders reported cutting home prices to bolster sales.
Over a third cutting prices.
Yeah.
That's a clear sign of distress.
It is. It reflects the pressure they're under. And this brings us back to what we're calling the housing trap. The Fed, in its valiant fight against broad inflation, has inadvertently created this very difficult feedback loop. Think of it like this. To cool down the economy, they raise interest rates. Simple enough. But by doing that, they've effectively put those golden handcuffs on millions of homeowners, freezing up the supply of existing homes.
Right, which keeps prices high.
Exactly. Constrained supply plus persistent demand equals elevated home prices and rents. And shelter is a large lagging component of the CPI, the inflation index. So the Fed is fighting inflation partly by exacerbating a supply-side problem that actually contributes to inflation.
So they're kind of fighting themselves in a way.
In a way, yes. It's a classic case of trying to fix one problem and inadvertently making another worse, creating this vicious cycle. It places the Fed in a unique housing trap, where it may be forced to either tolerate higher than target inflation for a longer period or risk inducing a more severe housing market downturn to bring shelter costs under control. It's a real dilemma.
So they're trying to put out a fire, but their hose is inadvertently constricting the water supply needed elsewhere. That's quite the predicament. How do we ever get out of this housing trap, or do these golden handcuffs just stay on forever?
Well, they won't stay on forever, but this lock-in effect is expected to unwind only gradually, very gradually. The primary catalyst for unlocking homeowners will be those non-financial life events we talked about. Death, divorce, job relocation, family growth, things that necessitate a move regardless of the interest rate environment. Over a longer time horizon, the simple passage of time will also play a role. As homeowners pay down their loan balances, the mortgage becomes a smaller component of their overall financial picture, reducing its influence maybe on their decision to move. Data suggests a slow thaw is already underway. The share of homeowners with a mortgage rate under 6% is projected to decline from a peak of over 90% down to maybe 75% by the end of 2025.
Okay, so a slow decline as life happens.
Right. As some households are inevitably forced to move and take on new mortgages at higher rates, in this environment, home builders have turned heavily to mortgage rate buy-downs as their primary sales tool, offering buyers below market rates for the initial years of their loan, sometimes 2 or 3 points lower.
Those 2-1 buy-downs and things like that.
Exactly. While this has proven effective at maintaining some sales velocity, it is a costly margin-eroding strategy for the builders. It also functions by pulling future demand into the present, essentially borrowing from future sales. This creates a dependency on incentives. If builders were to withdraw these subsidies before market rates fall substantially, their sales would likely collapse as their products become suddenly much less affordable. So this dynamic represents a significant risk to future builder profitability if the Federal Reserve is forced to keep interest rates higher for longer than current market expectations.
Wow, so it's a real tightrope walk for everyone involved, buyers, sellers, builders, and the Fed. Beyond these immediate pressing concerns about interest rates, it sounds like there are even more fundamental long-term issues making it incredibly hard to build homes cheaply enough to meet demand. What are these foundational constraints?
You're absolutely right. Beyond the immediate pressures of interest rates, the U.S. residential construction sector is grappling with a trifecta of fundamental long-term constraints. These are volatile input costs, a structural labor deficit, and a scarcity of entitled land. And these foundational issues create a high and sticky cost base for new construction, further entrenching the nation's affordability crisis. First, let's talk about input costs. The extreme price swings for building materials seen during the pandemic have moderated somewhat, but costs have not returned to pre-pandemic levels.
We're just stuck higher now.
Pretty much. Instead, a new higher baseline has been established, with persistent conflation across most major input categories. The Producer Price Index for construction materials was up over 2% year-over-year in June 2025. And this isn't just slight inflation, it's a permanent reset in many ways. Forget pre-pandemic prices, they feel like a ghost of the past. Take lumber, for instance. As of June 2025, it was up 7.7% year-over-year and still almost 20% above its pre-COVID level. Tariffs remain an ongoing risk there, too.
Right, lumber's always volatile. What about other materials?
Steel is way up, 44% above pre-pandemic levels, partly impacted by those 50% tariffs imposed in 2024. Concrete saw strong price increases, up over 15% in 2024 due to strong demand. Copper, a key component in plumbing and wiring, is up over 50% above pre-COVID levels. And even the cost of transportation and logistics remains a major inflationary pressure. Major freight carriers like FedEx and UPS implemented rate increases around 5.9% for 2025. Plus, you have geopolitical risks like disruptions in the Red Sea impacting shipping. So what's fascinating here is that even as some volatility moderates, the underlying cost structure for new homes has fundamentally shifted upwards. It simply costs more to put up a house now.
So it's not just materials, the physical stuff. Finding enough people to actually build these homes is a massive challenge too, isn't it? The labor side.
Absolutely. The construction industry is contending with a severe and structural shortage of skilled labor. This is a problem that has been decades in the making and shows no signs of really abating. An analysis by the Associated Builders and Contractors estimates that the industry will need to attract an additional nearly 440,000 workers in 2025 just to meet current demand.
Almost 500,000 workers needed this year alone.
Yeah, it's a huge number. This deficit is the result of a long-term trend of an aging workforce retiring at a faster rate than new, younger workers are entering the trades. Plus, the perception of construction as a difficult and maybe less desirable career path has also led to a decline in vocational training programs, further shrinking the talent pipeline. This chronic labor scarcity has created intense competition for available workers, driving significant wage inflation. Average hourly earnings for all of instruction employees rose by approximately 4.4% year over year in early 2025, a rate that outpaced overall private sector wage growth.
So construction wages are rising faster than average.
They are. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reported a median annual wage for construction and extraction occupations of over $58,000 in May 2024, which is higher than the median for all occupations. This premium directly translates to higher construction costs. Moreover, the shortage is most pronounced in specialized trades requiring significant training, think electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters, heavy equipment operators. A lack of qualified workers in these critical roles creates bottlenecks on job sites, leading to project delays, reduced productivity, and further upward pressure on labor costs. It's a real constraint.
Okay, costs are up, labor is scarce and expensive, and finally, where do you even build these homes, and what rules do you have to follow? This sounds like another invisible, but maybe significant, layer of complexity and cost.
It absolutely is. The final component of the cost structure is the land itself. And the availability and price of that land are heavily influenced by local government regulations. Now, while vast amounts of land are federally owned in the U.S., the overwhelming majority is located out west and in Alaska, far from the major population centers in the Northeast and Midwest, where housing shortages are often most acute.
So just releasing federal land isn't a silver bullet?
Not really. It offers only a limited, localized solution at best. The core issue is not a lack of raw land, but a scarcity of land that is zoned and entitled for residential development in areas with existing infrastructure and economic opportunity, where people actually want and need to live. And restrictive local zoning ordinances are a primary impediment to increasing housing supply. Across many American cities, it's estimated that a staggering 75% of all residential land is zoned exclusively for single-family detached homes.
3/4 just for single family.
Yeah. These ordinances often mandate large minimum lot sizes, minimum parking requirements, strict height limits, all things that collectively make it illegal to build more affordable, higher density housing types like duplexes, townhomes, or small apartment buildings in many places. According to the National Association of Home Builders, these regulatory compliance costs alone can add nearly $94,000 to the price of an average new home.
Wow, almost $100,000 just in regulatory costs.
It's a significant chunk. Furthermore, navigating the local permitting process is frequently a lengthy, complex, and uncertain endeavor. It adds significant time and carrying costs to development projects. And necessary environmental regulations, while important, also play a role by restricting the use of certain parcels of land and adding compliance costs and time to the development process. So if we connect this to the bigger picture, all these factors, materials, labor, land, regulation, create what you might call a sticky-up cost structure. The cost to build a new home is fundamentally higher than it was pre-pandemic and is unlikely to revert without significant regulatory changes at the local level. This creates a firm floor under new home prices, making it exceedingly difficult to address the affordability crisis through supply-side solutions alone without those changes. For prices to fall meaningfully, builder profit margins would have to be completely eroded, which would inevitably lead to a halt in construction, thereby worsening the very supply shortage that is propping up prices in the first place. It's a tough cycle.
That's a really stark picture of the challenges. It sounds like a lot of this national data can be misleading. because the U.S. housing market is really a tale of two markets, or maybe even many markets, depending on where you look. Let's break down these regional realities, because what you're experiencing might be very different from someone just a few states away.
Indeed, that's exactly right. The national housing market data, which suggests broad stagnation, really conceals a sharp divergence in performance at the regional and metropolitan levels. We are currently experiencing a tale of two housing markets, one of correction and rebalancing in those pandemic-era boomtowns, mostly in the South and West, and another of continued price stability and tight supply, generally in the Northeast and Midwest. This regional differentiation is critical for assessing risk. On one hand, you have the high-growth markets. Despite the challenging national environment, several metropolitan areas continue to exhibit strong underlying fundamentals. These are driven by robust job growth, positive population inflows, and, importantly, a more affordable cost of living relative to the major coastal hubs.
Where are these spots mostly?
These markets are concentrated primarily in the Southeast and Texas. Think cities like Dallas, Jacksonville, San Antonio, Charlotte, maybe Huntsville, Alabama. They're consistently ranked as top markets for real estate investment due to their diversified economies and sustained population growth. And this strong demand is fueling ongoing construction activity. States like Idaho, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Utah are leading the nation in the rate of new housing units authorized per capita, indicating that builders are actively working to meet the influx of new residents there.
Okay, so those are the areas where people are still flocking to, and builders are trying at least to keep up. But then you have the other side of that coin, the markets that are seeing pretty significant corrections. Which areas are those, and what's driving the shift there?
Right.
In stark contrast, you have the distressed or correcting markets. These are the areas that experienced the most frenzied price appreciation during the pandemic, and now they're undergoing the most significant corrections. As remote work trends have normalized somewhat, and that initial wave of pandemic-driven migration has subsided, demand in these areas has cooled while housing supply has increased a bit, shifting negotiating power firmly back to buyers. Austin, Texas, as we mentioned, is the prime example. Single-family home prices fell that staggering 23% from their 2022 peak.
Still reeling from that boom. Absolutely. Other pandemic boomtowns experiencing notable price declines from their peaks include Oakland, California, down 22%, San Francisco at negative 16%, Phoenix at negative 9%, Denver negative 10%, even Tampa down about 3.6%. This cooling is concentrated in the South and West, where inventory levels may be recovered more quickly, or prices just got completely detached from local incomes. Now, what's fascinating here, or important maybe, is that this correction in the Sun Belt and West isn't necessarily a sign of fundamental economic collapse in those areas. It's more like a necessary and healthy reversion to the mean. These markets witnessed unsustainable price growth, sometimes over 60% in just 2 years, far outpacing any growth in local incomes. Affordability was just stretched to breaking point.
So it's a correction, not a crash.
That's the view. The current downturn is a market mechanism to realign home prices with the underlying economic fundamentals of the region. And because these areas generally continue to benefit from strong long-term job and population growth drivers, the expectation is that once prices stabilize at a more affordable level, these positive demographic trends will reassert themselves. That should create a floor under the market and pave the way for a future recovery. And furthermore, the COVID-19 pandemic acted as a powerful accelerant for a pre-existing trend. Migration from dense, expensive urban cores to more spacious and affordable suburban and exurban communities. The widespread adoption of remote and hybrid work untethered millions of households from the need for a daily commute, allowing them to prioritize lifestyle factors, bigger homes, yards, maybe better schools.
The flight to the suburbs got supercharged.
Exactly. This shift is clearly visible in construction patterns. Single-family housing starts, predominantly suburban, have remained more resilient than multifamily starts, which are more concentrated in urban centers. Developers have responded by focusing on suburban master-planned communities and those mixed-use suburban developments we talked about, trying to blend suburban space with urban walkability. However, this rapid suburban expansion is now encountering significant challenges, particularly strained infrastructure, roads, schools, utilities, which often weren't designed to accommodate such rapid population growth.
Growing pains for the suburbs. Okay, so we've seen how affordability is hitting the first-time buyer segment hard, creating these regional differences. But what about the luxury market? Is it feeling the same pain, or is it a different story at the top end?
Lastly, the affordability crisis has created a stark performance gap between the luxury and affordable segments of the housing market. It's really two different worlds. The high-end market has demonstrated remarkable resilience. Luxury buyers are typically less reliant on mortgage financing. You see a high proportion of all cash transactions.
Right. Rates matter less if you're paying cash.
Exactly. That makes them less sensitive to fluctuations in interest rates. This demographic has also benefited disproportionately from significant wealth accumulation through a strong stock market and appreciation of other assets over the last decade or so. As a result, demand in the luxury segment, particularly for homes priced above, say, $10 million, remains robust. Markets with strong high-income job growth and international appeal like Los Angeles, Boston, Seattle, Nashville continue to be ranked as top destinations for high-end buyers. Conversely, the affordable and entry-level segments of the market are bearing the full brunt of the current crisis. The combination of record high prices and mortgage rates near 7% has pushed the cost of a typical entry-level home far beyond the financial capacity of most first-time buyers and low to moderate income households. This has led to that collapse in transaction volume for lower priced homes and the declining share of first-time buyers in the market, as we discussed earlier. It's a tough situation for them.
Okay, so the current challenges are immense, from interest rates to labor and land, affecting different segments and regions differently. It almost sounds like an impossible situation for builders sometimes. But where's the silver lining here? How can technology help dig us out of this hole, or at least help home builders adapt and maybe improve affordability or efficiency?
This is a critical area. And indeed, the profound challenges facing the residential construction industry are creating a powerful impetus for technological innovation. It's often adversity that spurs change, right? Companies that successfully adopt and scale new technologies in construction, property transactions, and sustainable design will likely build a significant and durable competitive advantage. Let's start with construction technology, or ConTech. This includes things like modular building, 3D printing, and automation. While still in its early stages, the adoption of these advanced construction technologies is beginning to accelerate as builders seek solutions to those fundamental cost and labor problems. Currently, off-site construction methods like modular and panelization represent a pretty small fraction of the market, fewer than 20,000 modular homes built annually in the U.S.
Still pretty niche, then.
Relatively, yes. However, the 3D printing construction market, though starting from a very small base, is projected to experience explosive growth. Some forecasts predict a compound annual growth rate of over 111% between 2025 and 2030.
Wow, 111% growth rate, that's huge, even from a small base.
It is, and this is no longer just a niche occupied by startups. The industry's largest players are now making significant investments. For instance, Lennar, the nation's second largest home builder, has formed a high-profile partnership with 3D printing technology company Icon. They're developing entire communities of 3D printed homes in Texas. Their first 100 home project has been successful, with 75% of the homes sold as of March 2025. And a second, larger 200 home project is now planned. This demonstrates a potentially viable path to scalable production.
That's incredible. Entire 3D printed communities. What's the real promise of these technologies like 3D printing and modular? How do they help solve the big issues we've been discussing, like cost and labor?
Well, the promise of these technologies is potentially transformative. They offer the potential to dramatically reduce construction timelines. They can minimize material waste, maybe by up to 40% in some cases, and they can lower on-site labor requirements, which is huge given the shortages. So this directly addresses the industry's most persistent and inflationary challenges, particularly the labor shortage and rising material costs. Builders who invest in and successfully integrate these technologies into their production processes will be better positioned to control costs. In an environment of persistent wage inflation and material price volatility, ConTech could serve as a powerful inflation hedge for them. And this operational advantage should translate directly into more stable profit margins and potentially the ability to offer more competitive pricing, enabling these innovators to gain market share over time.
Then there's property technology, or PropTech. This is really about digitizing the entire real estate transaction from search to close. PropTech platforms like Zillow, Redfin, Huzzeo, they've empowered consumers with unprecedented access to information.
An estimated 43% of home buyers now begin their search for a new home online. They're using these platforms to view listings, take 3D virtual tours, research market data, all before ever contacting a real estate agent.
Making the search much more efficient.
Exactly. It has made the home search process much more efficient and transparent. PropTech is also removing friction from the transaction itself. The rise of iBuyers like Opendoor, which provides sellers with instant data-driven cash offers for their homes, is particularly impactful for the new construction market.
How so? How do iBuyers help new construction?
Well, builders are increasingly partnering with these platforms. They provide a seamless solution for would-be buyers who have an existing home to sell first. It removes that financing contingency, the need to sell your old house before buying the new one, which can often delay or derail a new home purchase. It simplifies the process. The overall PropTech market is poised for massive growth, projected to expand from approximately $40 billion in 2025 to over $133 billion by 2032.
Okay, so technology is helping with the building process and the buying-selling process. Beyond just efficiency, what about what buyers actually want in their homes now? Are there technological shifts happening there that builders are responding to?
Absolutely. Consumer preferences and, frankly, regulatory mandates are driving a powerful trend toward more sustainable, energy-efficient, and technologically integrated homes. Green building is rapidly moving from a niche market to a mainstream expectation.
People want lower utility bills.
Exactly. It's driven by both consumer demand for lower utility bills and a desire for a smaller environmental footprint, but also by increasingly stringent government regulations and building codes like LED standards. Key trends in the space include the push toward net zero energy buildings homes that produce as much energy as they consume annually. Also, the use of sustainable and recycled materials like reclaimed wood or low-carbon concrete, and the integration of advanced water conservation systems like rainwater harvesting or greywater recycling. And then, the demand for integrated smart home technology has become nearly universal among new home buyers. It's almost an expectation now. The smart home market is projected to generate over $170 billion in revenue in 2025, with household penetration expected to reach nearly 78%.
Almost 80% penetration. What's driving that?
Convenience. Convenience is huge, yes. Also, enhanced security and energy management thanks smart thermostats learning your schedule. The ecosystem is rapidly evolving too, with AI-powered smart assistants and new interoperability standards like Matter, creating more seamless and intuitive user experiences between different devices. In response, home builders are increasingly including comprehensive smart home packages, featuring smart thermostats, lighting, locks, security systems as standard features in their new homes. These are no longer just fancy add-ons, they're becoming foundational elements that buyers expect in a modern home.
Okay, so we've talked about the immense challenges, the complex underlying factors like demographics and affordability, the crucial role of interest rates, and also the technological innovations trying to address some of these issues. Mm. Now, the big question, how do we know when the tide is turning? What are the specific signals we should be looking for to understand if and when the housing market truly starts to recover from this stagnation?
Yeah, this raises an important question. What exactly would a recovery look like on the ground, and how would we measure it? Our sources highlight a series of leading indicators across financial, economic, and market-specific categories that, taken together, would signal a durable turnaround. On the financial side, the mortgage applications, MBA Purchase Index, which comes out weekly, is the most immediate barometer of buyer demand. A sustained increase there, moving beyond just normal seasonal ups and downs, would be an early sign that potential buyers are re-engaging.
Okay, mortgage applications first. What else?
Builder confidence, measured by that NAHB housing market index we mentioned, it needs a decisive and sustained move back above the 50-point neutral threshold. That would indicate builders are seeing improved traffic and sales, giving them the confidence to actually increase construction again. We'd also watch bank lending standards from the Federal Reserve's Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey. A net easing of standards for those AD&C loans would signal capital becoming more available for new projects.
So money flowing more easily to builders again. Makes sense. What about broader economic signs?
From an economic perspective, a clear and sustained deceleration in the shelter component of the Consumer Price Index, CPI, is really a prerequisite. The Fed needs to see that housing inflation is cooling before they'll feel comfortable cutting interest rates more aggressively. It's a key macro indicator for the housing market's direct impact on overall inflation. And critically, continued strength in the labor market, specifically employment and wage growth, is essential. That provides the income foundation for housing demand. Nominal wage growth must consistently outpace home price appreciation for a while to begin repairing the damage to affordability.
Wages catching up to prices, finally.
Yeah.
And specific market indicators. Things happening with listings or inventory.
Right. And finally, market indicators. A significant and sustained increase in new listings for existing homes would be the first concrete evidence that the rate lock-in effect is beginning to thaw. That's essential for a healthy, functioning market. A rebalancing will also be evident when the months of supply for new homes begins to decline from its current elevated levels, while the inventory of existing homes rises back towards a more balanced 5 to 6 month supply. Lastly, a decrease in the share of listings with price reductions would signal that the market is finding a stable price floor and that seller expectations are aligning better with buyer capacity.
That's a great dashboard of indicators to watch. Now, nobody has a crystal ball, of course, but analysts have sketched out a few potential paths this recovery could take. What are the main scenarios and their potential timelines? How long could this stagnation realistically last?
That's right. The timeline for a full market recovery is highly dependent on the path of inflation and the corresponding reaction of the Federal Reserve. Our sources outline three broad scenarios. The optimistic scenario suggests a recovery perhaps in 12-18 months. This would be catalyzed by a faster than expected decline in inflation, prompting the Federal Reserve to begin a more aggressive rate cutting cycle, maybe starting early in 2025. In this view, mortgage rates would then fall toward the 5.5% range by late 2025.
5.5%, that would feel a lot better.
It would. This would unlock a significant wave of pent-up demand from sideline buyers and provide meaningful relief to the rate lock-in effect. That could lead to a sharp rebound in both new and existing home sales volume in the second half of 2025 and into 2026.
Okay, that's the optimistic view. What's more likely?
The base case, which aligns with current consensus forecasts and is generally considered the most probable outcome, anticipates a longer recovery, maybe 24, 36 months, 2 to 3 years. In this scenario, inflation proves to be sticky, maybe more persistent than hoped. This leads the Federal Reserve to proceed with only cautious and gradual rate cuts, perhaps beginning late in 2025 and continuing through 2026. Mortgage rates would slowly decline, eventually settling in a kind of new normal range, maybe 5.75% to 6.25%.
So still higher than pre-pandemic, but lower than now.
Exactly. The market would experience a slow, grinding recovery characterized by a gradual normalization of resale inventory, modest sales growth, and selective price appreciation, mainly in the most supply-constrained markets.
Okay, slow and steady. What's the downside risk? The pessimistic view?
Yeah, finally, there's a pessimistic scenario, which could see a recovery lasting 3 to 5 years or even longer. In this outlook, maybe a second wave of inflation emerges, perhaps triggered by geopolitical shocks, persistent wage pressures, or the inflationary effects of tariffs. This forces the Federal Reserve to hold interest rates at current levels for an extended period, or maybe even to resume hiking rates. Mortgage rates would remain near or above 7%.
Oof, higher for even longer.
Right. This would lead to a prolonged period of deep stagnation with chronically low transaction volumes. Eventually, sustained economic weakness could begin to erode homeowner balance sheets, potentially leading to modest but widespread price declines. This scenario could even result in what some call structural demand destruction, where a significant portion of a generation of potential buyers effectively gives up on the prospect of homeownership for an extended period.
That pessimistic scenario sounds quite grim indeed. So regardless of which path we take, fast, medium, or slow, how would the market recovery actually unfold? Are there distinct phases we can expect to see?
Yes, regardless of the specific timeline, the market recovery is expected to proceed through four distinct phases, broadly speaking. We're currently in the stabilization phase, likely through the second half of 2025. This phase is defined by the conditions we've discussed: extremely low transaction volumes, elevated inventory levels for new homes, ongoing price corrections in those overheated markets, and general price stability elsewhere. Home builders are heavily reliant on sales incentives like buy-downs to generate activity.
Okay, stabilization first. What comes next?
Next would be the early recovery phase, perhaps anticipated for 2026 in the base case. This will be triggered by the first sustained series of rate cuts from the Federal Reserve, with mortgage rates beginning to trend consistently downward. Key leading indicators like the MBA Purchase Index and the NAHB Housing Market Index will show sustained improvement. And single-family construction starts will bottom out and begin to slowly increase.
Things starting to look up, but slowly.
Hey, following that, the growth phase, maybe in 2027. Mortgage rates will have stabilized at that new normal, likely in the 5-6% range. The rate lock-in effect will have meaningfully eased as the gap between legacy and current mortgage rates narrows. More people feel comfortable moving. This will lead to a healthier level of resale inventory and a return of sales volumes closer to historical norms. New construction will also ramp up more significantly to meet both renewed cyclical demand and the ongoing need to address the chronic housing deficit.
Getting back towards normal. And finally,
the maturation phase, maybe from 2028 onwards, where the market will find a new, sustainable equilibrium. Growth will then be driven primarily by underlying demographic trends and economic fundamentals, rather than by the volatile swings of monetary policy we're seeing now. Given this outlook, a comprehensive investment strategy needs to be grounded in a clear understanding of the risks inherent to the sector. There are cyclical risks, primarily that higher-for-longer interest rate scenario, which would prolong the stagnation and pressure profitability. Then there are structural risks, like the projected slowdown in household formation we discussed, the persistent shortage of skilled labor, and the potential for disruptive regulatory changes, either good or bad. And finally, company-specific risks. Here, balance sheet strength, the quality and location of land assets, and the proven ability of the management team to navigate complex market cycles are critical differentiators.
So assess the risks carefully, but where are the opportunities for value creation in this environment?
Despite these risks, the current market dislocation creates several avenues for significant value creation, according to our sources. The most compelling opportunity perhaps lies in market share consolidation. The current environment, with its high costs and reliance on financial incentives, is disproportionately harming smaller, less capitalized private builders. This is allowing the large, publicly traded home builders to aggressively capture market share, a trend that is likely to accelerate.
Big get bigger.
Essentially, yes. Also, innovation leaders companies at the forefront of adopting and scaling those innovative technologies like ConTech and PropTech will likely achieve a durable cost advantage. And finally, firms that supply essential non-discretionary building products and services, think aggregates, cement, roofing, insulation, will likely exhibit greater resilience and pricing power through the economic cycle.
Okay, so focusing on scale, innovation, and essentials.
Yeah.
Who are the specific winners and losers in this unique market, according to the analysis? What are some concrete recommendations from the sources?
Let's look at some sector-specific recommendations from the sources, keeping in mind this is based on their analysis. For home builders, the public home builders are seen as the primary beneficiaries of the paralyzed resale market. Their key competitive advantages are that superior access to capital, allowing them to finance land and offer attractive mortgage rate buy-downs, plus significant economies of scale. Lennar, LN, is highlighted as a top pick, rated BUY. They point to its asset-light strategy, its technology leadership, including that 3D printing partnership with Icon, and its strong balance sheet. D.R. Horton, DHI, is also a top pick, rated BUY. As the nation's largest home builder by volume, its sheer scale provides a huge competitive advantage. They also have a deep focus on the affordable entry-level segment with their Express Homes brand and a strong Sunbelt presence.
So positive on the big builders. What about the companies that supply them?
For building materials, performance is driven largely by pricing power on essential goods. CRH, PLC, CLH, is mentioned as a top pick, rated BUY. As the largest building materials company in North America, CRH holds a dominant market position in essential products like aggregates, asphalt, and cement. They have dual exposure to residential construction, but also to more resilient government-funded infrastructure projects, which provides a less cyclical demand base. Plus, their locally sourced products insulate them somewhat from international shipping and tariff risks.
Okay, essential materials look good. What about places like Home Depot or Lowe's? The home improvement retailers.
When it comes to home improvement retail, major retailers like the Home Depot and Lowe's are seen facing significant headwinds from the frozen existing home market. A large portion of their revenue, particularly from their professional customers, the Pro Desk, is driven by projects related to housing turnover, people fixing up homes to sell or renovating after buying.
Right. If fewer homes are selling, fewer big projects happen.
Exactly. With existing home sales at 30-year lows, this key demand driver is suppressed. While DIY demand remains okay, it's not enough to offset the weakness in the pro segment. So the recommendation here is generally neutral on the subsector. Their growth prospects are seen as directly tied to a recovery in housing transaction volume, which isn't anticipated in the base case scenario until 2026-2027.
Makes sense. And finally, the mortgage companies themselves, lenders, servicers.
Lastly, mortgage and financial services is viewed as the subsector most directly and negatively impacted by the current environment. High interest rates have decimated refinancing volume and severely reduced purchase mortgage volume. This results in a hyper-competitive market with very low profitability. The recommendation here is generally underweight the subsector. The business model is seen as fundamentally challenged by low volumes and high interest rate volatility, making the path to a profitable recovery long and uncertain.
Okay, underweight mortgage finance. So pulling it all together, what's the suggested investment strategy?
Based on this analysis, an appropriate portfolio strategy suggested by the sources would be to establish an overweight position in the stocks of well-capitalized, large-scale public home builders and select essential building materials suppliers. These companies are positioned to potentially gain market share and benefit from long-term structural tailwinds. Concurrently, the portfolio should be underweight in mortgage finance companies and home improvement retailers, given their direct exposure to the most challenged parts of the market right now. As an alternative or perhaps hedging strategy, investors could also consider publicly traded single-family and multifamily rental REITs.
Ah, the landlords.
Right. They stand to potentially benefit from the ongoing homeownership affordability crisis that keeps more households in the rental market for longer periods.
What a truly fascinating and maybe slightly sobering deep dive into a really complex market. We've covered so much ground. Everything from those powerful demographic shifts pushing for demand and the crushing affordability crisis pushing back to the paralyzing golden handcuffs effect caused by interest rates and even the exciting potential of 3D printed homes and smart home integration changing how we build and live. We've really unpacked the core paradox of this great stagnation. That it's not a collapse like 2008, but a unique collision of forces that has essentially frozen the resale market and given unprecedented power to new construction. The rate lock-in effect is clearly pivotal, as is the ongoing battle with input costs, labor shortages, and regulatory hurdles that make building new homes so challenging and expensive. But we've also seen how technology and innovation are starting to offer paths forward, hopefully giving us some long-term relief, though maybe not immediately.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this sustained period of housing stagnation, driven by these unique and often contradictory forces, it really does seem to fundamentally redefine what the American dream of homeownership means, especially for younger generations. It's shifting not just how homes are bought and sold, but even what type of homes are accessible and desirable. What stands out to you about how this might reshape our communities, our cities, and even our personal financial decisions over the next decade? It's a profound shift to consider, I think.
That's a great question to leave our listeners with. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the U.S. housing market. We hope you feel much more informed and ready to navigate these complex waters with a clearer understanding of the powerful forces at play.